Let's go back, however, to Schock's book, published in 1889. He continues as follows, quote, "The conspiracy against society is as determined as it ever was, and among every nation, the spirit of revolt is being galvanized into a newer and more dangerous life. In Europe, the same ferment is apparent. In England, the conspiracy is still largely undercover, but the propaganda is busy, and occasional rumblings may be heard of the work going on underground. The conspirators, safely covered by the fancied security of the people, are permitted to undermine at their will the fabric of English society. In France, the commune is stronger than it ever was, and the Red Terror may appear with every turn of the whirligig of politics. In Spain and Italy, and especially in the smaller states, the socialists are busy, while in Germany and in Russia, a crisis is at hand. Thus, the world over, governments are menaced with a danger before which foreign war is as nothing." Again, parenthetically, please note this next sentence. Quote, "Nothing but the uprooting of the very foundations and groundwork of our civilization will satisfy these enemies of order. Let none mistake either the purpose or the devotion of these fanatics, nor their growing strength. This is methodic, not a haphazard conspiracy. The ferment in Russia is controlled by the same heads and the same hands as the activity in Chicago. There is a cold-blooded, calculating purpose behind this revolt, manipulating every part of it the world over to a common and ruinous end." That's the end of the quotation. Now this, my friends, was a warning to the people of the United States in 1889, almost identical with the warning of John Robeson to the governments of Europe in 1798, and, let us repeat, it was about identically the same continuing conspiracy. It is the same warning which we, in the John Birch Society, have been proclaiming to our fellow citizens for years. The communist movement has now largely swallowed the nihilists, the anarchists, and such other raw instrumentalities of the overall command. But this whole combination of destructive forces is still being run by the same self-perpetuating international clique of usually silk-hatted and always power-hungry criminals, which has been undermining our civilization for almost 200 years. After 1848 and throughout the 19th century, the inner circle steadily tightened its organization of the total oligarchy and consolidated its control over subsidiary, affiliated, or independent revolutionary groups. It achieved ever more effective secrecy about its existence, its membership, and its activities. And its secret power grew by leaps and bounds, so that by around 1900, these insiders had already come to exercise tremendously subversive influence within practically all the governments of Europe, as well as the United States. And the separate thrusts of this influence were brilliantly meshed and coordinated by some central command, with more and more palpable results, which formed a new chapter for the conspiracy, and now deserve one from ourselves. Section 4. Far as the 20th century got underway, various parts of the great destructive plan began to materialize. The secret intrigues and activities of the insiders, already spreading like a vast poisonous vine throughout all governments and all human institutions, began increasingly to implant and to develop malignant weaknesses in the whole body of the civilized world. Insidious changes in the economic systems of the productive nations, revolutions and civil wars, and even world wars, now began to take place, not haphazardly or fortuitously, but all in due and measured sequence, according to one careful and comprehensive design. For these great tragic developments were all simply logical and confident steps in the strategy of the conspiracy. In the United States, in the first two decades of this century, these secret influences were accomplishing wonders for their evil cause without the American people having the slightest suspicion of what was taking place. The same forces that brought Woodrow Wilson and Edward Mandel House to power also instituted the graduated income tax and established the Federal Reserve System. This was strictly according to Project Number 2 and Project Number 5 in the program set forth by Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto for the Destruction of Capitalistic Nations. They put through the 17th Amendment for the direct election of United States Senators as the first great legalistic step in the planned change of our republic into a democracy. They established the tax-exempt foundation system, which would eventually put billions of dollars of liquid funds into the hands of insiders who would use the money to promote subversion and revolution. They provided midwives for the birth of many national organizations, such as the Federal Council of Churches, the NAACP, and the ADL, which would be so useful to them a generation later. Far more important than any of these accomplishments, however, in this or any other country, was their incitement of World War I. This was the most completely senseless and unjustified war in the history of mankind. There was no sound or legitimate reason for any of the nations involved to be in this war, and least of all for the United States. The whole thing had to be artificially and synthetically contrived by intrigues and pressures and propaganda designed exactly for that purpose. This horror was deliberately and cunningly inflicted on the human race by the insiders of the great conspiracy, for it was a tremendous step in carrying forward their satanic program. And the war became the means and supplied the opportunity for terrifically far-reaching destruction of the old order, exactly as had been planned. It was the First World War which undermined the Tsar's government and created so much chaos in Russia, even before it was over, that enabled Lenin and Trotsky to seize control. They were financed, it is worth noting, from Germany and the United States by insiders in both countries who were supposed to be at war with each other. But actually, they were only at war against civilization. And without the continuous help of these bosses of the conspiracy, with their influence in the capitals of Europe and in New York and Washington, Lenin's communist regime would have had no chance of survival in Russia throughout its early years. It was the First World War fought under the revealing slogan to make the world safe for democracy that put such immense power into the hands of the then top American insider, Colonel Edward Mandel House. This was power which enabled House, with his fellow insiders from other countries at the Versailles Conference, and with the help of his brain trust of young would-be insiders, consisting of John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, Christian Herder, Walter Lippmann, and Norman Thomas, to carry out plans which would make it possible for the same conspiracy, and to some extent the same conspirators, to bring on a second world war just 20 years later. It was World War I which destroyed America's wise and proud independence of the old world squabbles, which wrought such great psychological changes in the outlook of the American people, and which carried the people of both Europe and America a huge step towards the one world concept that was so immensely important to the conspiracy. And it was all the excitement and action and propaganda connected with the war which enabled the communists and the insiders to increase their strength and their reach manyfold in the 10 years from 1912 to 1922. In fact, by 1922, the secret levers of power within the United States were already being grasped by the conspirators to an alarming extent without the people, or even most of the honorable men in government, having any real understanding of what had taken place. By that year, quite a number of comparatively new organizations, such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the League for Industrial Democracy, the Friends of Soviet Russia, the American Jewish Committee, and the Rand School for Social Science, had already earned the right to be described as communist fronts. And it would have greatly surprised most Americans, busy with their commercial and professional careers and happy with their so-called return to normalcy under the Harding administration to realize how many of their prominent fellow citizens were already busily engaged in actions or propaganda which helped the communist advance, and how many of them, in fact, had become prominent primarily because they were so engaged and had thus been given the benefit of all the helpful publicity and favorable treatment which the well-directed apparatus could put behind them. Such a list of active protégés and supporters of the communist movement as early as 1922 would have included Newton D. Baker, Jane Addams, Charles P. Steinmetz, Sidney Hillman, Norman Thomas, Walter Lippmann, Christian Herter, John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, Felix Warburg, Hayward Broome, Carrie Chapman Catt, Charlie Chaplin, Jacob Schiff, Stuart Chase, Scott Nearing, Amos Pinchot, Felix Frankfurter, William C. Bullitt, Upton Close, Bishop William Montgomery Brown, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, Reverend Harry F. Ward, Lincoln Steffens, Upton Sinclair, Harry Laidler, John Dewey, Rexford Tugwell, Jack London, Carl Van Doren, William Allen White, Theodore Dreiser, Paul H. Douglas, Zona Gale, and hundreds more. The agitation and propaganda stage of revolutionary activities within the United States, the communists call it agitprop, was well underway. That was over 45 years ago, and the combined power of the insiders, their communist stooges, and the communist fellow travelers, when thrown with full force into any one undertaking, was fully revealed for the first time in what happened to the Harding administration. Harding had been elected president by the wave of revulsion among the American people against involvement in foreign war, against the plan to involve them further in the intrigues and troubles of the whole world through the League of Nations, and against the steady movement towards socialism right here at home. The insiders and their agents had not been able to prevent that return to normalcy, but they were determined to make the setback as temporary as possible. For despite this necessity of rolling with the punch, they were still very conscious of all the muscle they had acquired during the World War years. So, when Harry M. Doherty, who was certainly one of the best attorney generals the United States has ever had, raided the secret and illegal communist convention in Bridgeman, Michigan in 1922, and later in the same year took steps to stop the incredibly brazen crimes and defiance of law which revolutionary radicals had injected into the Great Railroad Strike, he immediately became the target of a smear campaign unparalleled in previous American history. This monumental and ruthless combination of frame-up, falsehoods, and distortions was soon turned on the Harding administration as a whole. The conspiratorial nature of this all-out attack was so little understood or even suspected by the American people that the reputations of some very able, honorable, and patriotic men, and especially of Harry Doherty and of Harding himself, have remained clouded by it to this day. Exactly the same kind of concerted and continuous smear campaign that had destroyed a king and queen of France four generations earlier had now proved its effectiveness in the United States for repeated use on future occasions. It was to be applied in all-out fashion 30 years later to the destruction of Senator Joseph McCarthy, and 40 years later it was to be applied with even more comprehensive and continuous efforts to that attempted undermining and destruction of the John Birch Society, which undermining still continues unabated and with amazing variety and viciousness. We shall now have to telescope some of this history into even smaller proportions. But fortunately, most of it from here on is better understood. The stock market crash in the fall of 1929 and the depression that followed were used by the communists to weaken the faith of the American people in our free enterprise system and to prepare the way for government intervention on a massive scale. And with the inauguration of Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932, a whole new phase began of more rapid progress by the conspirators towards their ultimate goal. The communist regime in Russia was saved from collapse through the prestige and credit accruing to it from the official recognition by our government. This opened the gates at once for a constant stream of communist agents and spies to enter our country and to begin to entrench themselves in jobs within our federal bureaucracy, as well as in every other division of our national life. The banks were all closed together by government decree and then reopened separately by government permission to show us how we had to be protected by our government from the follies and wickedness of private business. And our money was taken off the gold standard domestically and its intrinsic value arbitrarily changed by the criminal action of Roosevelt's administration as the first long step toward the intended future condition when it would become only fiat money altogether. Pigs were killed and crops were plowed under. Public boondoggles were begun on a massive scale, and government direction and controls were introduced into every part of our economy to get the people to believe and accept the thesis that government had to and was able to provide for their welfare. And by 1939, a depression which normally would have been completely over and forgotten in 5 years had been kept in effect for 10 years by all of these government interferences with the normal working of the American system. What's more, it had all been planned that way. But by 1937, the insiders of the world were ready, and Stalin was ready in Russia to bring on their second world war. The first steps in the United States to that end began with Roosevelt's quarantine speech, which exactly reversed what had supposedly been our foreign policy during those years of interlude when the communists were making their necessary hay on the domestic scene. Now, gradually but rapidly, all the artifices of worldwide intrigue were applied and all the stops were pulled out in the organs of propaganda to get this war underway and then to push us into it as rapidly as possible. When even these gigantic efforts proved inadequate or too slow, Stalin precipitated the war in Europe by his devious and temporary alliance with Hitler for the invasion of Poland. In due course, Franklin Roosevelt and George Marshall harried and enticed the Japanese into attacking us at Pearl Harbor. And thus, World War II began the new, tremendously further developed phase of the conspiracy's advance for which the war had been planned. This advance was on all fronts. Within the United States, the spending and taxes that could be instituted and the controls and powers that could be exercised by a government engaged in a full-scale world war made actions of the same kind for which the Depression had served as an excuse look like merely weak rehearsals by children at play. Even more important, however, was the fact that this war officially made the communists the allies of so many of the leading nations of the world. Under these circumstances, the insiders and the communists rapidly maneuvered themselves into such effective control almost everywhere that the whole war was fought, especially by the United States, and tactically as well as strategically, with aid to the imperialistic designs of the communists as the objective overriding all others. This Second World War, with its immense psychological as well as sociological impact, carried the disruption and destruction of the old order of civilization tremendously further than any depths which had been reached before. It prepared the way for that steady undermining and disintegration of all the traditional and humane elements of the old order which have continued ever since. And more specifically, this war and its aftermath provided the chaos and confusion and suffering and despair in Eastern and Central Europe and in Eastern Asia, which gave the communists the opportunity for all of their conquests that followed. And finally, all of the circumstances and propaganda accompanying World War II enabled the communists to bring about one result of greater value to their plans than any of the others we have listed. For communism is truly international. The subjugation of any one country by the communists is always aided by, or even the direct result of, international conniving. And the very sad but incontrovertible and fully proved fact, my friends, is that since 1940, the most important and powerful single force in carrying forward the communist advance all over the world has been the United States government. The activist groups within each country that gradually took over that country were usually directed from Moscow. But the money and prestige and economic help and diplomatic pressures that made each attempted subjugation successful were largely supplied from Washington. If this shocks you, stop and think about the actual and known history in each case. Poland was not lost to the communists during 1945 to 1947 in Warsaw, even though the Lublin gang of communist traitors there supplied the framework for the takeover. Poland was lost in Washington by the help of our government to the Lublin gang, as arranged and carried out by Dean Acheson. The whole horrible story is told and fully documented in I Saw Poland Betrayed by Arthur Bliss Lane, our ambassador to Poland at the time, a book which cost him his career and eventually his life. Algeria was not lost to the communists in Algeria or even in Paris. The long and cruel terror of the activist FLN and the cunning betrayal of his own country by the incredibly ruthless Charles de Gaulle were vital to this development, of course. But the pro-communist drive and prestige which gave the FLN guerrilla massacres the status of a civil war, and which enabled de Gaulle to carry out his treason at Evian, had long been supplied from Washington, primarily through the efforts of Henry Cabot Lodge and the then Senator John F. Kennedy. And that record, too, is as clear as day. China was not lost in Chongqing, Canton, or Shanghai, but in Washington, through the unceasing help to Mao Zedong and the undermining of Chiang Kai-shek by General George Marshall in our State Department. There were a dozen books which laid this on the line right while it was happening, but they were all smothered so that the American people would not know the truth. And you can find the record of that smothering and its results in just one small book, While You Slept, by John T. Flynn. Cuba was not lost in Havana, but again by the deliberate actions of our government in Washington. Castro's guerrillas supplied the framework for the takeover, but it was the unceasing help to Castro and undermining of Batista by Milton Eisenhower, Christian Herder, and the whole Eisenhower administration which brought Castro to power and which kept him there during those touch-and-go early years. Again, that record has been made clear by, among others, our former ambassador to Cuba, who saw the betrayal taking place. And the same story, with very little change in its broad outline, has been true and has been amply proved in books you were never given the chance to read in the case of almost every territorial advance the communists have ever made. Let us incorporate into our story at this point, therefore, a brief review of their geographical progress during the last 50 years. For the open record of this success is a central fact of our contemporary history. That record began in 1917, when Lenin was able, with Trotsky and only a few hundred followers, to take the Russian Revolution out of the hands of its earlier leaders and convert it into a communist strike for power. Then, by the use of almost incredible audacity and terror, they seized control of Russia itself. In 1918, these communist usurpers established some degree of stability and recognition for their regime by the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with Germany. And by 1922, they had extended their infiltration, terror, and control enough to set up the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The communists were able to bring into this USSR, besides the greatly reduced Russia proper left them at the time of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, the further areas of Russian Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Ukraine, and Belarusia. And with this combination as a base, Lenin and his successors, notably Stalin, set out patiently and resolutely to conquer the world. For reasons too involved for us to go into them here, the strategy for this global conquest was laid down by Lenin in advice which has been summarized and paraphrased as follows. First, we will take Eastern Europe. Next, the masses of Asia. Then we shall encircle that last bastion of capitalism, the United States of America. We shall not have to attack. It will fall like overripe fruit into our hands. Now, ladies and gentlemen, The communists have never wavered from that three-step strategy one iota, nor from any part of it, nor from the methods by which this advance was to be carried out. For Lenin was not thinking or talking about conquering all of these other nations in due course by communist military might, any more than Russia itself had been taken by such means. He was referring to the eventual seizure of power in one country after another through infiltration, subversion, and propaganda, through creating a civil war, or at least the semblance of civil war, within each target country, and by all of the diplomatic, economic, political, and coercive pressures that could then be exercised against the legitimate government of each intended victim by communist agents and allies in the leading capitals of the world. From 1922 to 1939, however, most of the energy, cunning, and cruelty of the conspiracy was spent on strengthening its position of infiltration and influence within various countries, including the United States, rather than in actual efforts to take them over. Only in China and in Spain were such efforts made, and even these appear to have been largely premature and preparatory for the global conquests to be undertaken later. But World War II completed all of these preparations. With the help of the conditions created by that war, which we have already mentioned, and with the unceasing aid of the American government to the Soviets throughout that war and during the years immediately after it, Stalin moved fast and far ahead according to the blueprint laid out by Lenin. By 1948, the Soviets had imposed their brutal communist tyranny over Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Albania, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and East Germany. The communists now had Eastern Europe entire, and the first step of their program was complete.
This concludes cassette number one in this series of three cassettes.